Hello. Welcome to the Holden Village Media Ministry. You will be listening to a tape by Michael Wilker entitled God the Economist, God the Homemaker. Today's date is June 8, 1998. The call number on this tape is WIM98-1. Let's listen in.
Welcome again. My name is Mike Wilker. I am from Watsonville, California, currently. I'm a Lutheran pastor there at a small congregation. And a lot of what I am struggling with and our congregation is struggling with as we try to follow Christ is where my courses this week will be arising from. Faith and economic life, our daily bread. I would like to begin by having us just take a moment of silence. Usually I like to pray at the beginning, but I'm going to hold our prayers collectively until later on. So let's just take a moment to begin. I invite you to open your eyes and come back and join us now. First question that I want to put out for a discussion with very little introduction other than what I've said is to ask you, what is the economy? How would you describe the economy?
It's high.
The economy is high? Oh, why high? How do you?
Everything. You know, food and all those things are, I mean, it's just risen.
So the cost is high.
Yeah, you know, everything is.
I'm going to write down words that you say. Okay. Other ways, what is economy?
Goods and services.
Goods and services.
The exchange of goods and services.
Americans are blessed.
Spoiled.
Spoiled.
The global network.
I heard Chris say global.
Mark.
Oh, Mark said that?
Yeah.
Okay.
It's okay.
And you said global network.
Yeah.
I would call it political power.
Political power.
Maya agrees.
I'll add a little word of introduction here. My daughter Maya is 8.5 months old, and my wife Judy Kittleson are sitting up in our balcony there, so I hear them every once in a while. And you, just because you're sitting up there doesn't mean that you can't participate in the discussion. Maya knows that.
She knows that.
Feel free to.
Thank you.
Any other ways to describe the economy?
Unequal.
I'm struck by, I forgot when it was, but one of the worship services, someone was reading from Larry Rasmussen's book, Earth, Community, Earth Ethics, and talking about economy as the rules of the house, like a way of organizing a household, which really struck me as unusual. Description of economy, but very interesting.
Organization.
The original meaning.
All right. I'm getting low to ground, she says. Good. Okay. Well, we've got the economy kind of with some words there describing that. Now, how do you describe Christian faith? I'm going to put that on the side of the board. Because we're talking about economic life and Christian faith. So how do you describe Christian faith?
Contrast society.
A contrast society. Do you know, what do you mean by contrast?
I mean an attempt to be different or countercultural.
To the rest of society. Mm-hmm.
A belief in action.
Belief and action, or belief
in action?
Action. Okay. Anything else?
I would say, as a contrast to economy, equal.
Equal?
Color should be seen as equal.
I would say there's a high cost.
High cost.
A little different.
How do you see it different, even though you're using the same word? She was talking about prices and...
Well, actually, maybe sort of the same. I think there is a high cost to truly what Christians do that we kind of want to ignore.
You said something about a way of life, too. That we live a Christian faith, and you kind of connects up with belief in action,
right.
I think, too. So, something, I'll quote, something we live.
How about? This high cost is of choosing. This high cost is not of choosing.
Oh, uh-huh. Not choice. Anybody want to say anything about God in terms of our Christian faith?
We should put on their radical, I think, I was going to just say this, radical confidence in the promises of God.
Okay. Radical confidence. Do you teach theology?
No.
In the promises of God.
Well, if this isn't correct, I would like to be corrected.
Oh.
I think it's a gift of the Holy Spirit.
Okay. That's good. Gift of Holy Spirit. Yes.
And under something we live, something that strikes me as distinctive about Christian faith is that it's life lived, you could say, on behalf of the world, or life lived for others. Part of following Jesus is following his self-sacrifice.
Mm-hmm. Oh, so it's following Jesus, too. And his self-sacrifice. All right. That's I really like these. That's good. And I like this, too. I think, too, about Christian faith. When I think about it, one of the things that's been really helpful for me is to think about it not so much in terms of that noun, faith, but in terms of the verb trust. And so when he said confidence, radical confidence, the word in Latin for trust is right in here, fide. It's made into a noun here in this form, but it's still, it's a trust. I trust God is our faith. Excellent. Now, I wanted to give you two, I'm going to erase, well, I'll leave these up here for a second. Isn't it interesting that when we talk about the economy, that God never came up here? And you almost didn't bring up God when you talked about it. Maybe I should have prompted you to say, is God in here? That's part of my question today, is where is God in the economy? Because we've talked about all of these things, and in our common parlance today, God isn't in the economy, really. In a way, we have this idea about, well, there should be a separation between church and state, but we don't even have the question about, should there be a separation of church and the economy, the church and the marketplace, because that's not even a question. out on the table, really, in my estimation. We don't think about it like that. So here's from the Lutheran Church in America. When they passed a statement in, 1980, I think it was, on economic justice, they also defined the economy in this way. The economy is a pattern of relationships, processes, institutions, and regulations, together with the values underlying them, by which the activities of production, distribution, and consumption are carried out in and among societies and cultures. Now, in our group, we kind of came up with that, a lot of those same things. We have a network, kind of relationships, a pattern of relationships, processes, exchanges. We don't really have institutions up here, but that's one of the things that the LCA, Lutheran Church in America, saw, like banks and corporations, things like that. We do have one institution, a household, up here. Production, distribution, and consumption. So kind of goods and services that are produced and consumed. We added the high cost. Interesting, in here it doesn't say too much about the cost of being in that kind of an economy. But again, isn't it interesting that the Lutheran Church in America defines the economy and says nothing about God in it? They're using a definition that's basically coming out of the culture and society in which we live in. This would be a very understandable definition if you were taking Economics 101 at St. Olaf College or something like that. That they would say, oh yeah, this is what economy is. So keep in mind that part of economy when I give you a different definition. And here, I'm going to write this one on the board. This is a working definition for me. I've been trying to find some other place that has a definition like this, and I haven't yet. There's probably one out there, but I just haven't looked hard enough. I'm putting it in blue. Economy. Describes the relationship. Plural, relationships. And activities. By which God provides. I'm getting ahead of myself. Provides. Redeems and sustains life for all creation. So that's how I'm thinking about economy these days. So I had a question, you know, where is God in the traditional, or what's become the traditional definition of economy? I also had a question in here, and in that Lutheran Church in America definition, it doesn't say anything about people, about creation, about animals, or anything like that in there either. The economy could almost operate independently of human bodies by this description. It could be a computer that's just exchanging information or things back and forth, or an automaton. You know, it might be something that was set up by somebody, but then somehow a machine from that side of the room changes the apples and moves it over there to that side of the room and gets oranges and has it brought over to that side of the room. It doesn't have to have people involved. But this, so I tried to create a definition in which God is the actor, the primary actor, the subject, and that includes creation. and I put human beings in as part of creation. Human beings, now if I had another sentence that I would put up here, I'd say human beings are blessed and called by God to participate in God's activity of providing, redeeming, and sustaining life for all creation. So that's an interesting definition of what human beings are too. Human beings are blessed and called to participate in God's activity of providing, redeeming, and sustaining life. So, what do you think about that definition?
Very nervous.
Is this a model? Is this a model that it should be? But in reality, through economies, and I'm thinking worldwide, not just our own, they can be very oppressive peoples. So is this the reality when man is selfish, greedy? Is this the way it should be, and the way we can participate in it to be to help it to become that way?
Yeah, that's very good. When I was trying to come up with this definition, I thought, what about sin? Because economy, as I experience, is fraught with a lot of sin and suffering that I suffer or that I cause other people to suffer. And so that's why, if I had that other sentence, human beings are blessed and called to participate, then I might add a third sentence that says, you know, but we don't always participate fully as God intends. We don't answer the call, and we don't see it as a blessing to participate. And we're not participating for life of all creation. You know how Chris talked about that our faith is lived on behalf of the world? I think that when we're not receiving it as a blessing and answering it as a call, we're also then not participating for the life of creation. So that's the knot in there is my acknowledgement of sin, that we have some freedom in whether we participate or how we accept the gift. Like I said, it's just a working definition, but that's a very important point that I'm glad you brought up, because we need to have it brought up. You said that it made you nervous.
Yeah, I think for some similar reasons. Like you said, this is a definition of economy that goes against the grain of our common cultural understanding of economy, as you know, just the interactions and transactions. And I see a potential, and I have seen a potential, I should say, for Christians to oversimplify and to say that to be good Christians, they should participate in the economy, they should be good consumers, they should pray to Christ about the color of furniture that they choose, or, you know, this kind of thing. And that getting rich for Jesus is a big thing. And, you know, that leads to kind of understanding that being wealthy is a sign that, you know, that this is God's favor. I think that's a common thing.
And then loses the point you brought up initially, that being a disciple of Jesus means not being just like the world around you, that there's some things that cut back across the grain.
This juncture.
Yeah, the common understanding that I've had, as you know, as far as economy is concerned, is that the Christian's duty is to opt out of it, of the conventional definition of economy in that sense. So this really challenges me. I guess that's why it really makes me.
Okay. Good. Betsy, and then you. So Betsy, you saw your hand.
One thing your definition does, it's interesting that most of our definitions, and the thing you went right for there was money. When we think of economy, we think of money.
Oh.
But your definition goes way, 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 way beyond money. Relationships and activities. When we think about giving help to other countries, for example, we might talk about, okay, we should give them money. Money isn't always going to help people. It isn't going to provide, redeem, and sustain life. some people need the gift of time. They need something that's going to save them time in their lives so that they can rest. And your definition, I think, really challenges the assumption that economy is money, because I think that's too narrow.
Money, I think, can be part
certainly,
of this relationships and activities,
part of it.
Because here's sometimes we think about money is part of an economic framework of what's become the traditional economic framework of things is money is capital, and capital we sometimes think of is a physical thing, like the chair. The chair is capital, or that machine that drives us up and down from the boat is capital. But capital really is a web of relationships and processes that that give a value to something. And that value is exchanged. And so money only has value because it operates within relationships and activities.
Right.
Capital only has value because it operates within that relationships and activities.
It seems to me economy would be more all things created by God and how that is divided and used by humans.
Mm-hmm. So you're saying that by having redeeming and sustaining in there, or maybe redeemed? I'm wondering. Maybe I'm having a question here of myself I'm revealing.
It seems like everything's part of the economy.
Mm-hmm.
And all things are created by God.
Mm-hmm.
So that puts God in it, like your definition does. But to not have man in as part of the definition of the economy, that's what, to me, feels incomplete.
Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm. And so the other way acknowledges, it includes everything God's created, but it's then how we use and divide that creation.
Another way to look at that might be to imagine a world in which there weren't any humans. Then you could still have relationships and activities which God provides, redeems, and sustains, but it doesn't make sense to me to talk about it in economic terms.
Uh-huh.
I mean, a world in which there weren't kind of activities we think of as economic, or it's just a world before humans were here. I mean, is there an economy there?
Uh-huh.
Okay, very good point. It almost sounds more ecological than economic in that sense.
Is there a sound in the woods if there's no one to hear it?
Yeah.
Good. Let's move on. Is there an eraser here?
No, but you can use a piece of... Oh, is there an eraser?
There's one in my next room.
Oh, excellent.
Thank you. Well, I'm going to leave this for a little while and do some background exploration on three different concepts. But I've really appreciated the discussion around what's lacking in this definition and what's challenging you. Because like I said, I'm working on this, and I'm trying to find a way that includes God in the economy. Raise these things.
But I would tend to agree with you. I mean, I see the point of wanting to include God in the economy because as a society we tend to exclude God purposely. But it almost seems as God to the point of excluding humankind by that definition.
This is really wild, because this is one of the things that was one of my main criticisms of my seminary professors in their teaching. No, so it's interesting that I'm getting this criticism. Some of the classical theories of atonement, of the work of Jesus Christ and what Jesus Christ does, I think, leave human beings out of it or as just kind of bystanders. So it's kind of interesting that this is coming up here to me. Betsy, you mentioned something kind of under your breath, or I didn't bring it out because I wanted to bring it out now. You mentioned the original idea of economy.
Mm.
And why did you say that? What were you thinking of there?
Well, I was thinking again of the thing we heard the other night.
Larry Rasmussen.
The derivation of the word economy was not what we think of it now.
Uh-huh.
It was more how you run your personal affairs, your household.
Right.
It didn't have this huge global connotation. Mm-hmm. The meaning has definitely changed over the years.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, over 2,000 years.
Yeah.
The word that we get economy from is rooted in Greek, and it's oikos. So it's kind of transformed into English, but and first into Latin, then. So oikos refers to the household. Now, in the scriptures in the New Testament, it's used primarily in two different ways. I was thinking it was going to talk about the household of faith, the Christian community, but if you do a word study on it, it doesn't use oikos in quite that same way. It first talks about oikos as, this is really hard for me to get around it, but God's plan. And let me read an example of that. In Ephesians chapter, yeah, that's a good one. Here's my Bible. There's a few references here. This is from the first chapter of Ephesians. And when you hear the word plan, that's the word oikos. With all wisdom and insight, God has made known to us the mystery of his will, according to his good pleasure that he set forth in Christ as a plan for the fullness of time, to gather up all things in him, things in heaven and things on earth. So, in that sense, oikos is God's plan for the fullness and the gathering up of all things in heaven and on earth in Christ. Then the letter to Ephesians also uses it as not only plan, but commission. In chapter 3, this is the beginning of chapter 3. This is the reason that I, Paul, am a prisoner for Christ Jesus for the sake of you Gentiles. For surely you have already heard of the commission of God's grace that was given me for you, and how the mystery was made known to me by revelation, as I wrote above in a few words. So Paul understands it, or the writer of Ephesians understands it as the commission to help reveal God's plan, which in some senses is a mystery. But it's a mystery that's being revealed through Christ to us. So, this is an interesting derivation how Paul is using, in the early Christian writings, are using oikos in terms of God's plan for all of creation, heaven and earth, and of the commission of followers of Christ to help in that plan. Revealing that plan. Then, oikos did become to be talked about as the household of faith a little bit later. That oikos was, you know, this Christian community that gathers for worship, this household, and how we understand things together. We had all things in common was a way that they understood the household of faith in the book of Acts. The New Testament, then we start getting into the other Greek writers and the early church leaders. And they started talking about it then as the economy of God. They used oikos, or household, or economy, as a way to describe the divine activity within the Trinity. I was one of the people who told Kevin that I liked the Trinity. And I was one of those pastors here that likes the Trinity. So it became a way to talk about the divine activity of God. Of the Trinity. So if you were going to do a big study on the early Christian understandings of the Trinity, you'd be bumping up against this word oikos a lot of places. And how they used it was not so much as the household part, but as the relationships between the three persons of the Trinity and how they interacted with one another, what their activities were and their relationships. So that's partly where I was thinking of this coming from, to relationships and activity. So, and related to the doctrine of the Trinity. Then, the word oikos began to be expanded to see the whole household of the world or of creation. So that's how kind of the development of it in our over 2,000 years, this expansion from in regular common parlance was the household, but then in the Christian church they started using it to describe God's plan or mystery and our commission, then the household of faith, the divine activity of the Trinity, the three persons, and then the household is God's creation. Now, sometimes we think about economy, the economy that we live in, we think that there is no other way to do economy than what we currently have. And what we have right now is called a market economy. It's an economy that's based upon the exchange of goods and services. And the way that that exchange takes place is through what's called a costly choice. I have this chair, and I see you have that book. And I determine that I would like that book. So I do an assessment to find out what do I have that I can exchange for that book. I have to give up something that's a cost to me to choose to have that book. And you also have to make a decision. You have to decide that you would rather have this chair than that book. And if you don't want this chair, then it's not going to be an exchange. So this kind of market, sometimes we talk about it bartering in a certain way, but it becomes an exchange based upon a costly price. And how we, or how traditional economists talk about it now too, is that it is, in your concept, I was almost thinking that you were saying we have to pay those high prices. We have no choice. You did say no choice, or someone said no choice there.
Yeah,
no choice in paying the high cost. In this market economy, the definition of this exchange also has an understanding that I am free to make that exchange. That I am not coerced by a king, ruler, lord, boss, or anything else, that it's because I have this chair that I can make a free choice of what to do with this chair. I can exchange it for the book and give it away, or I can choose freely to keep it. Now, it's really strange because what's happened is that that understanding of the market economy masks, I think, what we all realize, is that there is a certain sense of domination and of a not freedom, or of a slavery in the market economy. That there are things that how the market economy has become construed that we feel we have no choice. I need to get bread to feed my family. I don't have a choice in that. the only thing that I have is my body or what I might have inherited from my family, and that my choices are limited by what I originally have. And so I have to give up either part of my body or the sweat of my brow or something that I've had, and that I don't have any choice in that. So that's market economy. Let me see here. This market economy in the 17th and 18th centuries, they wanted to try, and the economic leaders and the philosophers of that time were really concerned about the domination of people in terms of political rights and personal rights. And so they were looking for ways to free human beings of the constraints and the coercion of the domination of the king or of the rulers or the feudal lords. And they started to see that this nascent market economy that was growing could be a way to free people from domination from the kings and the rulers. Because now I can exchange because I want to, not because the king tells me I have to, you know, give up my property to the king. I can have property myself. And they construed a theory that says that's how human beings can be free. And more than that, it evolved by saying that there are natural laws that govern this exchange. And the natural laws are my wants and desires and your wants and desires built into a collective. And so suddenly human wants and desires become seen as natural laws. And as one of the philosophers, Hegel, said, those laws are then immutable. They're unchangeable. And that's the laws that govern society. What Hegel also said was that the only real things that are not governed by those economic laws are the interior, our private selves, our families. So there became this split between the public was ruled by these immutable laws, or as what Adam Smith said was the invisible hand. And this part of ourselves, we were still free to make decisions about, irregardless of those laws of exchange. Hegel was saying, you know, you don't pay to have your children. That's not an exchange, a costly exchange. Now, later on, people are saying, well, no. Especially Marxists started looking at the family, saying, wait a minute, there's an exchange going on here, too. A woman and a man give up certain things so that they can live together and have a household economy together. But it was seen as, this market economy was seen as something really great because it removed the domination of the ruler or the lord. Now, I wanted to do oikos, market economy, and the last thing is livelihood. Because what happens in a market economy the content of economics is the exchange. That's what becomes the center of focus. Livelihood, though, is a different kind of concept. Livelihood is how we live the day, what it takes for us to be sustained through the day. Livelihood includes bodily needs like the food that I eat, the shelter that I have, the clothing that I need to wear. And it also includes, it's kind of a large definition, it also includes those other things that I need to live, like nurturing, education, a way of understanding the world, moral choices, but especially as they're related to material things. So let's take education as an example. Education is part of our concept of livelihood, or our concept of livelihood, because it involves teachers, other people, a place to study, perhaps books, things like that. So that's part of my livelihood, and it's about teaching me how I can live through the day. You know, think about what is some of the most important things that we teach our babies. Well, I'm teaching my baby how to feed herself, and give her a banana, and you know. But we had to watch it because at first she would choke, and she needed to kind of be helped along with how to chew those things in smaller bits so that she could swallow them and all. So it's an education for how to live through the day. In the market economy, livelihood, this kind of how we live through the day, has been replaced by the understanding of exchange. No longer are we concerned about how am I living? How am I surviving and thriving? That's not an object for discussion. The only point of study is this exchange that goes on between you and I. And so it takes out the market economy that we live in, takes out a consideration of how we basically live. Which, you know, leaves out hundreds of thousands of people because they don't participate in an exchange. The Bhopal disaster in India. There was a chemical plant in the middle of a community, and certain people worked in that chemical plant, but thousands of people didn't have any relationship to what was produced there, or where it went, or where the money, the resources, the value that was added there made. But they lived in proximity to it. In Bhopal, when the disaster at the chemical plant struck, 2,000 people died. Most of those folks had no exchange with that plant there. So when they were studying the economics of having the plant there, they didn't care about all the people that were living nearby, because they're not involved in an exchange with the plant. They're not giving their labor, they're not doing anything. But if we think about how they lived through the day, that plant meant they died. It directly impacted their livelihood. So that's why in the new statements that are being drafted by the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America, this is a big disjuncture here that is kind of hidden. It's trying to make a big point, but the contrast between livelihood and exchange is a very big one. And the ELCA draft statement on faith and economic life says that as Christians we should be about coming toward a sustainable, sufficient livelihood for all. And so the statement makes livelihood the matter of study, and partly what the real world we live in, the real market economy, is exchange. But that's something that when you look at that at some point, think about livelihood. That's why I wanted to bring it up. Okay. Now, I want to do an activity here. Any questions first before we do the activity about household market economy and livelihood and those kind of base concepts?
Well, just that the strikes me that the richness of the relationships implied in the early usages of oikos are really narrowed when you get to the current understanding of market economy and exchange and what that entails, especially when the value is abstracted from the value of a chair or some real object into the value of money, which is sort of hollow. It's like, you know, it's hard to see in a price on the chair the relationship between that dollar figure and the labor that went into it. If it was an artisan who made it and labored over the curving of the wood and the sanding smooth of the grain and all of that. Mm-hmm. So livelihood, I think, because it seems to restore some of the richness and multi-layered sense of relationship in exchange.
Yeah, awesome. And then the chair, then we can ask the question about the chair. How does it help us live? How did it help the person who made it live? How is it helping us live?
Or interestingly, Nike tennis shoes, which has been in the news mm-hmm. recently. It's obvious to me how it helps me live, but it's a more difficult question to ask how working for the manufacturer in Indonesia helps the people who make the shoe live. And that's been one of the central issues, is Nike, the corporate practices of livelihood for the people who assemble the shoes.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yep. It also brings back responsibility for other people. When you were talking about the chair and the book, it was like, do I want the book? Mm-hmm. Does he want the chair? Mm-hmm. It wasn't thinking about a community sense there either. The livelihood issue brings that back also, mm-hmm. which I think is an important aspect to have in the definition of the economy, ethical definition.
I had an experience at home where I had snow on my roof, so I called this man that in the neighborhood that was always doing things for people. So he said he'd come over, there would be a little charge, so he came over and took the snow off. Then he called me later and asked me if I would do his patching for him, that he would not charge me. But, you know, I'm done patching. And so I said no, so then I had to pay for it, uh-huh. you know. And where I could have, you know, helped him.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And instead I was selfish. But that's almost a similar thing, but there you're dealing with material things, and here I was dealing with another human being. Mm-hmm.
But your money still helped me.
Yeah.
Yes. You were not totally selfish. Uh-huh.
Yeah. Thanks. Well, now back to our question about where is God. One of the reasons this really has come home to me is I grew up on a hog farm in southern Minnesota. Not a hop farm, as it says on that. Though I like beer. It's a hog farm. Or it was a hog farm until just last week. My ancestors, four generations ago, moved to southern Minnesota and started farming there. And my brother, just last week, because of a debt load that was burdensome and other relationships going on, decided to sell the land. And so this is a huge thing in my family going on. In fact, what's happening between for my brother and in my brother's life and in his family's life, and then in relationship to my parents who live just 3 miles down the road, and who ever since Kent is my brother's name, when he was about in eighth grade, that's kind of when he decided he wanted to be a farmer. So they spent, from him being in eighth grade, the next 15 years of their lives basically figuring out how they could help set him up so that he could be a successful farmer in the market economy. And he spent a whole year, first part of it suffering on his own with this burden, then coming out in explosive ways in his family, and finally shared with his wife, who is a teacher, who's not a farmer herself, isn't involved in the production there, with her what was happening and the suffering that he was going through. And then finally brought it up to my parents. And so there's all this grief that's happening. And I felt like I wanted to not come here because I wanted to be with my family. Because the land is no longer owned by my family. And my mother, was really distraught, as all of us have been, and she was talking with me, and she said, your father and I have been praying for 4 years every day about our economic situation. And we keep asking, where is God? Where is God in all of this? So that question, where is God, is very personal for my family because of this story. It's coming out of my mom's experience. And so I want you to think about that with me. One concept, I'm going to get us started briefly by... Remember the folks who are trying to help create the market economy, they're reacting against some God concepts, really, that were, and I used them, telegraphing to you, king, ruler, master, lord. What are some other ones that go in with this kind of body? Lawgiver?
Maker.
These are all in the realm of God as above everything, God being the owner of everything, and that God distributes, and God gives to everything what it needs. These kind of concepts are very common in our Bible, but they're also shared with the ancient Greeks, like Aristotle and Plato. And in our Christian theology, we've adopted some ways that Aristotle and Plato have thought about these, in terms of that the king, since the king is the owner of everything, doesn't really need any other human beings involved. God, in this sense, is very much separate from human beings, and is just the owner of creation, the master and lord and lawgiver and maker. In this way, as this kind of theology was being developed, it was very helpful to human beings who were these things, because they could use kind of these God concepts as a way to bolster their own positions as emperors, kings, rulers, lords. So I'm the lord of this manor, and I get to say what all goes here. And that's how decisions are made. In this market economy, Adam Smith talked about these decisions being made by the invisible hand. And Adam Smith, in the 17th century, we're in the 20th century, he was in the 1700s. So I'll just say it that way. Adam Smith still saw this as God. God was the invisible hand for Adam Smith, that help kind of control these market forces and help make decisions. But as economic theory developed, they said, no, God's not doing that. Where they put the invisible hand in modern economic theory is, like I said a little bit earlier, God is really only the collective of human wants and desires. So the decisions about the economy are not made by a ruler or king, but the decisions are made by collective human wants and desires. It's really idolatrous, blasphemous, because it equates human beings with God. And that's a big problem. Adam Smith wasn't that far yet, but he just said God was unseen. Immortal, invisible, God only wise. That's Adam Smith's God. So now, I want you to think that I've got some resources here. We've got 5 minutes. So I'm going to split you up into a few groups, and I'm going to have you look at some resources that we use here at Holden Village. And I want you to think about the God concepts, how God is described in terms of livelihood and life for all in these resources. So let's see, 1, 2. I need 4 groups. So how about you 4 here? And then Betsy and you 3 back there. And how about before you move, just wait. I'll split you up and then I'll give you the things. You 4 and you 4. Okay? I want you guys here to look at the Eucharistic prayer that we used last night. Yes, you know, I want you guys to look at our table prayers here. How do we describe God and God's relationship to life and the economy? I want you to look at the immortal, invisible, godly, wise, and the song that we sang as we made worship. Translated as steadfast love. It's really connected to here and this intimate connection. And that is God's righteousness, is the ability to keep God's promise to be steadfast and loving. That's what defines God, is the embodiment of that steadfast love. And we see it in the New Testament embodied in Jesus Christ, who calls us to eat with one another, calls everyone to the table like Holy Wisdom did, invites all, and then becomes the very food which God serves us. So that's where we'll end today. We've got some other things tomorrow. I'm going to be looking at a holy energy, the power of a Christian community.